Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live on this Monday morning. Been an interesting couple of months for the crypto space. We saw Bitcoin's rally last weekend, and now we see the price of the cryptocurrency sitting closer to $40,000 here after having traded down towards $30,000 during most of the month of July. And joining us now to talk about the state of institutional adoption within the crypto space and sort of where the bull cycle is headed from here, we're joined by Raghu Yarlagadda, the CEO at Falcon X. Raghu, thanks so much for jumping on this morning. Let's just start with how you think about crypto as an institutional asset, especially, you know, we were just talking to an analyst about Square. We see Coinbase will be out with its results. On the back of a couple of major public companies, at MicroStrategy, so on and so forth, incorporating Bitcoin into where they sit, how does that change things for you guys on your part of the business?
Absolutely. First off, great to be here, Miles and Brian. So in terms of institutional adoption, just to give you a little bit of context on the timeline, May 2020 is when we saw the flurry of U.S. institutions coming into crypto, primarily around the narrative of Bitcoin being a good inflationary hedge. As that happened, around November is when the diversification happened to Asia and Europe. And around the January timeframe, corporate treasuries, we began seeing a lot of corporate treasuries coming in. And the core use case and the core narrative is what started as an inflationary hedge, diversified into stable coins. And now there's a lot of focus around yield generation, especially around this macro regime of world printing a lot of money. So to answer your question specifically, institutional demand over the last 1 month, is cautiously optimistic. They are definitely concerned about where or what is going to happen next, especially on the regulatory front. But that being said, the news cycle around Amazon, the new cycle around yield generation through different vehicles within crypto, that is definitely drawing a lot of attention. Specifically from Falcon X, we haven't seen a drop in institutional customers coming in. We're seeing a very healthy inflow of traditional institutions coming up and signing up to trade crypto.
Raghu, when you say you have the institutions coming in and trading crypto right now, how would you define an institution? Is that a hedge fund?
Oh, that's a great question. So we're seeing a very diverse set of personas, Brian, all the way from some of the world's largest hedge funds, crypto native funds, retail aggregators, neobanks, and commercial banks. Right now, most of the activity is around the hedge funds and the prop shops.
Raghu, I'm curious what you make of the stablecoin market now and what role that is playing. Because I think it covering, you know, U.S. financial markets, basically equities, I see these stablecoin headlines. I don't worry too much about them. But from your, you know, vantage point operating an exchange in this space, how does Tether fit into, creating a stable and really trusted, you know, crypto institutional market at this point?
Absolutely. A lot of U.S. Traditional institutions who are coming into the space, we haven't seen a ton of their activity in Tether. They've been focused on USDC, the Circle stablecoin. Some U.S. institutions and also quite a few of Asian institutions, they definitely do have exposure to Tether. But Miles, I think the important point to note is while everyone is watching what's happening with Tether on the regulatory front, a lot of the exposure to Tether is very transactional or temporal. As the news cycle about Tether came in about 2, 3, 4 weeks back, a lot of institutions moved to USDC. And some institutions came back again into Tether. So to answer your question, definitely Tether has a sizable role to play in the crypto macro ecosystem. There's no question about it. But because of the transactional nature, I think crypto as an ecosystem is a lot more robust, around the news cycles concerning Tether.
And then also on the yield side, you know, certainly big news that we saw last week out of FTX, and there's been a lot of conversation around just DeFi platforms and, you know, yield farming, all of these kinds of ideas. And has that generated questions, concerns, interests from your vantage point? And how do you see that sort of right sizing? I mean, you get 0% lending basically in the U.S. dollar market. How much longer till we see spreads compress, you know, from the crypto side?
Oh, that's a fascinating question, Miles. There's a lot of conversations around yield generation through decentralized finance. Specifically, the U.S. traditional institutions, I mean, in the regime of commercial banks paying anywhere from 40 to 80 basis points of interest rate, on the DeFi side, they're seeing about 4%. And building on the DeFi momentum, Coinbase and Circle offered institutional treasury products that, you know, that generate about 4% interest rate on an annualized basis. So that triggered, that stoked a lot of interest from the U.S. institutions specifically. Now, as they come in, they want to understand the underlying mechanics. I mean, how are we generating 4% yield? Part of it is through the trading activity. Bitcoin volatility generates a lot of demand for U.S. dollar for momentum traders to basically borrow. That is one source of yield generation. The second source of yield generation, which you're referring to, is around the decentralized finance through protocols like Compound and Aave. So right now, institutions are watching it very closely. They have a lot of questions, right? I mean, what's the soundness of the protocol? They're getting comfortable. We see a lot of institutions touching Compound through intermediaries like us. And but at the same time, I wouldn't say that they are completely fully on board on the decentralized finance side because they're waiting for clarity on the regulatory side of things, Miles.
And Raghu, I'm interested in your firm. Last thing I saw, or last numbers that I saw, you raised $50 million in March, valued the company at $675 million. Are you back in the market trying to raise more capital? Do you want to IPO sometime this year?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of demand, you know, coming from both traditional venture capitalists, hedge funds who are looking into the crypto space and the broader tokenization narrative, and also crossover funds, Brian. So there's a lot of inbound, and we're having conversations, like any good firm that's growing incredibly fast. But at the same time, like, you know, no announcement to make at the moment. We'll be, stay tuned. We're excited to be talking about that.
A masterful way, having conversations. Love that, Raghu. We're all having conversations all the time, of course, right? About all sorts of things. I appreciate the time this morning, Raghu Yalagada, CEO of Falcon X. Raghu, I'm sure we'll have you back. Thanks for jumping on.
Pet care platform Rover is no longer just an app. The company is making its market debut today on the NASDAQ after merging with a SPAC, the ticker symbol ROVR. Joining us now to discuss Rover is CEO Aaron Easterly. Aaron, good to see you here. Congrats on the debut here. I want to jump right into guidance here. We've seen the economy roar back. A lot more people are taking vacations. Are you still tracking to your 2021 guidance here of 3.9 million bookings and about 97 million in sales?
We originally put together a projection as part of the SPAC process and the S4. We actually upped our guidance above and beyond that projection for 2021 because of the strength that we are seeing in the year. So we're really excited about the progress today.
Have you been able to find workers to support that better than expected growth?
Yes, we're activating and bringing on service providers. Some of our service providers that were active during the pandemic have come back. But Rover is unique. People can have a dog in their home and go about the rest of their life. They can be a stay-at-home parent. They can be a software engineer. So doing Rover doesn't necessarily preclude you from doing other work that generates income as well, which is unique and different than a lot of companies.
And Aaron, I'm curious how much the pet boom during the pandemic has reshaped the way that you guys are thinking about the business. Obviously, those initial, you know, projections we're looking for, let's say, a return to work in 22, and then obviously that's going to create increased demand. But, I mean, are you guys seeing folks who are working at home still hiring a Rover walker? And how does just the boom in the number of pets out there change the way you think about some of your opportunities?
The first is the opportunity is bigger. The annual growth rate in pet adoption is roughly quadrupled during the pandemic. So there are a lot of new pet parents that are going to be trying to find care solutions for the first time. We also gained market share during the pandemic, which gives us an opportunity to be aggressive, which is why we wanted to raise the capital. With regards to the services, we've seen some interesting stuff in the data. We set a record earlier this year for daycare, which was weird for us given the lack of return to work that was taking place in April or March or May. And so we actually are seeing examples where pet parents don't want to be away from their pets for 8 hours without a human being checking in on them. So we think overall the pandemic has made us even closer to our furry friends.
Now, Aaron, you guys talked about an area that you guys that you are testing, which is grooming. My parents, recent pet parents, cannot find a groomer inside of basically 6 weeks here in the tri-state area. Have you started to expand that? And how are you thinking about building that specific network? Because that's certainly been a choke point, let's say, within the pet supply space.
So true. So our mission as Rovers, we want to make it possible for everyone to experience the unconditional love of a pet in their life. And one of the biggest reasons that people don't is actually concern over the logistics of care. What happens when I travel out of town? What happens when I go into work? I live in an apartment. I don't have a yard. Taking your dog to a groomer is not easy. Oftentimes they operate weekdays, 9:30 to 4:30. So we want to make that easier. And we have actually started our broader rollout across the U.S., not quite nationwide yet, but we're excited about that. And we think there's an opportunity to make the grooming experience a little bit more modern and a little bit more convenient for today's pet parent.
What you're seeing on the screen is a lot of the good boys and girls of the Yahoo Finance team, a lot of puppy and kitty owners here on the team. Aaron, I do want to ask you, there has been some reports of Rover and your competitor Wag having some difficulty caring for pets and people being tepid or scared to leave pets in your possession. How do you address those concerns?
Ultimately, word of mouth and our reputations are our greatest asset. But as an animal lover, like we all are at Rover, there is anxiety accompanied with leaving your child with someone new. We actually recommend that people do meet and greets. We are not like Uber. We're not like DoorDash. You don't push a button. Someone gets assigned. People actually choose who they want to use to care for their pet. And about 90% of the time for first-time customers, they actually go meet with them in advance. Making sure it's a choice you feel comfortable with is one of the best things you can do. But over time, we see that the percentage of people that have great experiences, over 95% of our stays are reviewed 5 stars. And word of mouth is actually our biggest source of customer acquisition. So the reputational dynamic becomes easier over time as most people have phenomenal experiences with Rover. But if you're a pet parent and you have anxiety about your pet being away from you, you're not alone. We get it, and I do too.
How do you screen? If I were to come and work for you, how would you screen me and do background check in me?
Yeah, so when you sign up to be a sitter or service provider on Rover, whether it's a dog walker or a boarding provider or daycare provider, you create a profile that includes photos, where you live. You can submit references, testimonials from people whose pets you've cared for before. You then go through a background check as well. The background check is intended to screen people with a criminal history that would be inappropriate for Rover. After that, you then go through a technology review where our technology looks at the traits of the profile and determines whether or not we think that person's likely to be successful. And then after that, you go through a human review. And only after all that do you get put on the site or the app. When we constantly review based on feedback from customers, whether they're meets and greets or actual stays, to determine the appropriateness of people remaining on the platform. Trust and safety is job one for us.
Aaron, how many pets do you own?
I own one incredibly high-energy Pomsky. So she looks like a little itty-bitty husky, but with the tenacity of a big one.
Well said. Definitely well said. I'll leave it there. Rover CEO Aaron Easterly, good luck on your public company journey. We'll talk to you soon.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
PepsiCo is shaking up its beverage portfolio. The company said today it will sell Tropicana, Naked, and other select juice brands to private equity firm PAI Partners. The transaction will net PepsiCo pre-tax cash proceeds of about $3.3 billion. It will also retain a 39% stake in the new joint venture. Joining us now for more is PepsiCo Vice Chairman and CFO Hugh Johnson. Hugh, what are you doing here? It's not earnings.
Good morning, Brian and Miles. How are you? Great to be with you.
We're hanging tough. Good to see you again here. So take us through this. Why do you decide to make this transaction?
Sure. You know, as PepsiCo, we're pretty focused on capital allocation and ensuring that we're always optimizing our portfolio to get the best results. And as we went through an exercise on that over the past 18 months or so, we came to the conclusion that given our orientation towards higher growth and improving our margins, Tropicana was probably less of a fit with the portfolio than it was before. So we made a decision that it probably made sense to move Tropicana elsewhere. At the same time, we thought there was some untapped potential in the business, and PAI as a private equity firm has got a great history of extracting value out of good assets like they did with Nestle with their Froneri transaction and Yoplait. So we put together a deal where we're going to participate in the upside going forward, but at the same time, we're going to focus the capital as well as our efforts against the categories that are higher growing. Oftentimes, that's going to be things like healthier snacks or zero-calorie beverages or, of course, our great SodaStream business.
Does this transaction help lift the profit margins in your North America beverage business? Does it take it to double digits now?
You know, it'll take it up. It doesn't quite get it to double digits, but it clearly is a move in the right direction in that regard. Now, that said, for the first half of this year, beverage margins have been double digits anyway. So we're feeling good about the progress on that. Our goal is obviously to get somewhere up around the mid-teens over the course of the next couple of years. And we've got a significant plan in place that Kirk Tanner, who runs the business, and myself and obviously our CEO are highly focused on executing against.
Now, Hugh, you guys talked in the most recent quarter, as you have for some time, about that $1 billion in savings through 2026 plan. And I'm curious how we're supposed to think about this in the context of that initiative, or is this maybe something different with respect to, you know, reshaping the portfolio?
Sure. No, those are completely separate. The $1 billion is the business that PepsiCo will be running going forward. So that number absolutely still remains the same. This is really just a portfolio optimization decision that we think makes sense, because if you look at what we've done recently in terms of M&A type activity, it's been mostly geared toward higher margin, higher growth businesses. Rockstar obviously is a higher margin business. The SodaStream deal was higher margin and higher growth. Pioneer is a great long-term growth play. So we've been steering the portfolio in that direction. That said, with the proceeds of this transaction, we expect to use these proceeds to strengthen the balance sheet and to organically invest back in the business.
Hugh, when you say strengthen the balance sheet, is this are you looking at a special dividend or raising your stock buyback plan, or this is almost all going to flow through to the bottom line?
No, it's really going to be geared. The portion that strengthened the balance sheet is about debt reduction, because obviously when you're losing EBITDA, you're going to take debt down as well in parallel with that. So that was what that reference was about.
Hugh, for as long as I've covered PepsiCo, I've only known the company to be an acquirer. Do you have other brands that you're looking at within the portfolio that may not fit any longer?
No, nothing to share today. What I would tell you, though, is we're always looking to optimize the portfolio. And you're right, Brian. Generally speaking, we have been an acquirer. But we've also refranchised bottling businesses over time in international as well. So we're constantly looking at how do we make this portfolio even better and even stronger so that we can grow it faster.
Now, lastly, real quick, Hugh, does PepsiCo deserve a higher multiple on its business today as compared to yesterday after this deal?
Well, I think the market will decide that for us. But, you know, my point of view is the multiple should always be higher.
Fair enough. Well, we'll be asking you about that multiple come earnings season, which is probably in a couple weeks. PepsiCo CFO and Vice Chairman Hugh Johnston, always good to see you.
Thanks. Great to be with you guys.
All right, welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. Lyft out last night, reporting better than expected revenues, also reporting adjusted EBITDA profitability for the first time, that coming in about a quarter or two sooner than the street had expected. We see here on the left side of the screen, however, shares now off some 7% in early trading. Joining us now to talk a little bit more about the quarter and the outlook for the business, Ali Mogarabi, Senior Equity Analyst over at Morningstar. Ali, thanks for joining us this morning. Let's just start with your impression when you saw that adjusted EBITDA EBITDA profitability, which, of course, has been much talked about with Lyft, and we'll see what happens with Uber this evening. But seeing that number come in, what were your first impressions of that?
Well, yeah, actually, I mean, basically, it was somewhat expected after you initially see that top-line growth, which was very impressive. So that revenue, that top-line, impressive top-line growth creates that operating leverage for these guys. And then on top of that, you know, what we've said historically about Lyft and also Uber is that they have this network effect competitive advantage, which means that as demand increases, more riders come on board. And, of course, as more riders available, the time making the request possible, and also to a certain extent, the prices will decline, which attracts additional riders. So what we're also seeing in this case, in terms of helping the adjusted EBITDA, is that the cost of acquisition for the riders is actually decreasing. And we saw that at sales and marketing as a percentage of revenue. So you put those together and, yeah, of course, you see the adjusted EBITDA being positive for the quarter.
Is the reaction today we're seeing the stock price, Ali, that the market just doesn't believe that Lyft could be sustainably profitable for the rest of the year as the Delta variant spreads, impacts the economy, and perhaps send a lot of folks not into Lyft cars, but back into their homes?
That could be part of it. Also, one of the economic indicators that went out today, the ADP and ADP employment numbers, I mean, that was a little bit disappointing. But keep in mind, you know, management did say, or the company did say, that in July, not only the supply of drivers was up significantly or continued to increase, but also demand on the rider side continued to increase. And we're talking about July, about a month after, you know, Delta variant came out there. So in our opinion, you know, as vaccinations increase, we don't think that the Delta variant is necessarily going to have a significant impact on these guys. It's, again, you know, the July numbers indicated. So we're pretty comfortable where we're at. You know, we're valuing the company at $63 a share. You know, we still, as we published last night, you know, we still think that we recommend for the investors to wait for a wider margin of safety, and it looks like it's moving towards that. We're probably recommending the stock at around, you know, the high 40s, $48, $49 a share. That's where we think that the stock becomes attractive.
And Ali, what'd you make of management's commentary last night about the wait times that, you know, we've discussed it here on the program. Anecdotally, of course, everyone that you know can give you a complaint about waiting for a Lyft or an Uber or how much it costs. And were you surprised by how much management kind of discussed those challenges at length? I was sort of bracing for them to say, you know, actually everything's fine. But for them to come out and talk about less than ideal pricing, at least to my mind, was a bit of a surprise.
Yes, it was a surprise to a certain extent. However, again, if you look back for the period, to the previous quarters, you actually did notice that on the supply side or the number of drivers, they were facing shortages. And that's very similar to Uber. So when there are not that many drivers out there, of course, the wait time increases, the prices increase to a certain extent because of that lack of balance between the supply and the demand. So, you know, we expected the management to at least point to that, focus on that a little bit. And they did, of course, also mention that they will continue to spend a little bit more to continue to attract the drivers onto that platform to basically balance out the demand and the supply, which, of course, helps decrease prices a little bit while at the same time increases volume to offset the impact of lower prices. But, you know, overall, we actually viewed the earnings results and the earnings call pretty positive.
The Lyft team, and you know this, Ali, just following the company, they've been on a hardcore cost-cutting campaign really from the fourth quarter of 2019. They have now proven that they can be profitable on pressured volumes. Is the company, have they set the stage to be acquired?
That's a good question. Not sure about that. And the main reason is that, at least in the U.S. market, which is basically where Lyft is participating the most. In the U.S. market, you have pretty much a duopoly, right? The Uber-Lyft market share is pretty much a 70-30. And because of that, since there are only two players, we did see price stabilization before the pandemic hit. And likely we will see price stabilization as, of course, the economy continues to return to, you know, normalcy in addition to regular consumer behavior. So, from that standpoint, it doesn't seem like there's a reason for Lyft to be preparing itself to be acquired. But that's our initial assumption and review.
All right, we'll leave it there. Ali Mogherabi, Senior Equity Analyst at Morningstar. Ali, thanks so much for jumping on to talk about Lyft this morning.
I want to switch over and check in on the action in the crypto space after SEC Chair Gary Gensler came out swinging with some updates on how he sees his agency stepping up regulations on tokens and lending platforms, not necessarily shaking up the prices here. Ethereum and Bitcoin both up today. In his thoughts, though, presented at the Aspen Security Forum, Gensler hinted at perhaps approving a Bitcoin ETF, even if it were limited to cash-settled CME-traded Bitcoin futures. So that might be a positive in some eyes. But the negatives, some people are pointing out, were focused more on pressure to label a lot of the other cryptocurrencies outside Bitcoin and Ether as securities. In a corresponding video on his Twitter, Gensler says it all boils down to investor protections. Take a listen.
I think that moving forward, promoting investor protection is not only good for you and for anyone who would consider investing in these assets. I think that it's the only real viable path forward for this nascent technology. See, at the heart of finance is trust, and trust rests on investor protection. And so that's what the SEC has to do with crypto investor protection.
Shout out to the production value on that SEC video. I kind of like what they're doing there. But joining us now for more on what it all means, happy to bring back on Caitlin Long, CEO of Avanti Bank, one of the few licensed and regulated crypto banks in the space. And Caitlin, I mean, there's a lot to dig into when it comes to not just what we're hearing from Gary Gensler, but also what Congress is trying to do here. But we'll start with what we heard from the top of the SEC yesterday. I mean, what jumped out to you about maybe clarification on either the Bitcoin ETF that people have been waiting for there, or maybe more pressure on things that aren't Bitcoin?
Oh boy, yes, there's a lot going on, and Gensler is a huge part of it. I'm surprised he hasn't acted more up until this point. He's been in his role now for several months, and if you go back to his confirmation hearings, he was asking Congress for clarity. And what came out of yesterday's speech is that he's taking some positions in spite of the fact that Congress hasn't acted. So there's a jump ball going on. Is the SEC going to interpret its authority more broadly and start taking enforcement actions? Or is the SEC and, of course, other agencies in Washington going to wait for Congress to give them instructions? But very clearly, something's happening. And I must say, his video is interesting because consumer protection is at bottom one of the big concerns. There are bad actors in this sector. There are institutions that are doing things that, had they registered onshore in the United States, would be considered illegal and they would have been shut down already. But they're operating overseas, offshore, and in many cases actually serving Americans.
Yeah, it's interesting because you talk about maybe what they can do without getting more powers here from Congress. And one of those is kind of labeling what is a security and what's not. And he kind of waded into that. He didn't want to get into specific tokens, but I just want to read what he kind of had in his prepared speech there on that topic. He said, folks buying these tokens are anticipating profits. There's a small group of entrepreneurs and technologists standing up and nurturing the projects. I believe we have a crypto market now where many tokens may be unregistered securities without required disclosures or market oversight. This leaves prices open to manipulation. This leaves investors vulnerable. I mean, that is kind of what you're talking about here, investor protections. But there's a lot out there beyond Bitcoin and Ether. And you think about the exchanges being impacted here, maybe what you guys could offer being impacted. I mean, talk to me about how big that is and how hard it is for people to agree on what is a security and what's not.
Well, it's so interesting because the SEC almost 2 years ago put out guidance that was supposed to clarify this, and it's clear as mud. And the industry has been saying, we really would like to have clarity because we want to know where the guardrails are so we can stay within them. In most cases, the compliant actors are interested in staying within those guardrails. And that was one thing I disagreed with Gensler's speech yesterday when he said this is clear. It is not. It is clear as mud, and it does need to be further clarified. And what's happened is the SEC has taken the stick approach as opposed to the carrot approach, which is to use enforcement actions and sue the issuers of these tokens that may not have clarity. And instead, what the SEC should be doing is enabling the innovators who are trying to protect consumers and are not trying to defraud anyone by providing enabling guidance. And that is not what the SEC has done.
So there may not be more clarity right now, but it does give us a little insight into Gary Gensler's thinking. And this morning we heard him say that, look, if you look at the crypto exchanges, they're just not under the same regulatory regime, like a New York Stock Exchange, for example. I'm just curious if you think that they should be. Should they be treated as the same, or do you think there are separate tracks that need to be pursued?
Well, for exchanges in particular, there is really no regulatory regime for them. And again, most of the ones that are actively trying to do right are asking for clarity. They're not trying to evade the law. There are some offshore, of course, that are, but most of the onshore ones are not, and they do not fit within existing broker-dealer rules. We saw Chairman Powell testifying at the House Financial Services Committee a few weeks ago, for example, say that one corner of this industry, which is called stablecoins, stablecoins are US dollar equivalent tokens, and that they should be either regulated as bank deposits or as money market funds. But the problem is they don't fit within money market funds right now. The Federal Reserve has the ability to fit them within bank rules right now. They don't need Congress to act. It's very interesting that the Federal Reserve has not done so. They're not eating their own cooking. They're not living up to their own words. But the SEC, I think, does have its hands tied more than the Federal Reserve does on going ahead and saying, yes, here's how exchanges should be regulated. I think both the SEC wants to do that and the exchanges are expecting it. The problem is it doesn't fit within the existing laws and they need Congress to act. And we see what's going on up on Capitol Hill. It doesn't seem like anything's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, in that appeal for powers, you kind of laid out also a focus on not just kind of the tokens themselves, but now the institution, the crypto platforms that are kind of lending and allowing people to tap equity in their crypto holdings, and we've seen pressure mounted on some of those other protocols too. I mean, when you look at that space, did that catch your eye for something that maybe Gary Gensler would have high on his list of things to talk about and maybe the issues that we've talked about, you and I before, when it comes to those lending platforms not necessarily having any oversight there either?
Oh boy, that was the clearest shot fired, if you will, in Gensler's speech, in my view. There was a one line reference to crypto lending platforms, and it didn't mince words. It said if crypto lending platforms are engaged in securities activities, they are running afoul of the law. It's interesting because we have seen enforcement actions by state securities regulators. I think now we're up to 5 states in the last week or so against one of the crypto lending platforms in the United States. But the SEC itself has not gotten involved. And yet Gensler had that one line in his speech. It does seem that there's coordination happening among the regulators. It is worth noting, though, one of the things that that I think is difficult for folks who haven't been around and don't have the proverbial gray hair to understand is that the SEC has 5 years to go after bad actors here. They can take their time, whether you think that's fair or not. That's what the law is. And in the case of the Ripple lawsuit by the SEC, it took them 8 years. And the reason that they kept going for 3 years after the statute of limitations expired is that they had apparently agreed with Ripple to toll the statute of limitations to give themselves extra time. I actually think they need to act. I don't think those kinds of behaviors are helpful, to sue someone 8 years later over something that might actually be a valid dispute. The law mm-hmm. is not clear in some of these areas. But the SEC, just because they have not acted yet, it absolutely does not mean they won't. I think they will. They take their time and they get their ducks in a row first.
I think that's a good way to wrap here with the last question. And, I guess this might be veering a little bit outside of, what we normally ask you about, which is just kind of the price moves, just because of what we're seeing, Bitcoin and Ether seeing a pop. Of course, that's kind of been settled when we think about how the SEC might look at them as not securities. But it's interesting mm-hmm. to see the rest of the tokens and the rest of the space still in the green as well. And we know they're kind of linked. But if anything we got from yesterday, it would seem that they shouldn't be linked. And I guess, the question there would be what you make of the moves that we're now seeing in kind of investors maybe putting the weight on what you just said, that maybe they take this to mean we're in the clear here because the SEC hasn't done anything yet. So maybe it's going to be fine.
Well, I think it's some of it is in the price. It's hard to say how much, but it is true to, that Washington, D.C. has been telegraphing a big regulatory crackdown. It actually started on the day that Tether released its reserve asset allocation back in April, which, by the way, was the peak in Bitcoin's price. And at the time, I said that's not a coincidence because a lot of the big smart money at the time, you saw analysts telling their investors, get to the sidelines, there's a crackdown coming, and wait until it happens and then get back in. And indeed, that's kind of what the price action has telegraphed. But I think more interesting than the price action is the volume. The volume has collapsed as it's clear that certain of the intermediaries in the sector are definitely in the crosshairs and others are more likely to be clear. But again, until that all shakes out, I don't expect the volume to come back. But the price action, a lot of it is a function of scarcity, and that has nothing to do with regulators at the end of the day.
So many variables to walk through here. Caitlin, it's always good to have you break it down for us. Caitlin Long, Avanti Bank and Trust founder and CEO. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Elf Beauty had a pretty attractive Q1 earnings report. The cosmetics company topped earnings and revenue estimates, also raised its outlook for fiscal year 2022. Joining us now is Elf Beauty CEO Tarang Amin. Tarang, always good to see you. These are impressive numbers, albeit you are comparing them to the year of the pandemic, but net sales up 50% compared to a year ago, your 10th consecutive quarter of net sales growth. What drove those results for you at Elf?
Well, thanks for having me again. I would say it's continuation of our overall business model. We were strong entering the pandemic. We were strong throughout it. And I think we're even stronger now. And it fundamentally is about making the best of beauty accessible to every eye, lip, and face. And our strategy continues to work.
Now, I know that you're having a push right now to attract some younger customers, the Gen Z customers. How have the beauty trends changed for the Gen Zers compared to folks like myself that are millennials and even older?
Well, I think there are many commonalities. The love of this category in terms of new ideas and innovation, I think, resonates across all age groups. But we've had great success amongst Gen Z, really by our ability to engage them, by going on platforms like TikTok, being the first beauty company on Twitch and into gaming, really all the different ways that we engage. And we're now the second favorite brand among Gen Z in our space, and we continue to do really well amongst that group. And it's really about engaging.
Talk to me about some of the trends that you're seeing right now. What are consumers gravitating to, and has it changed during this pandemic?
Well, what we're really seeing is a strong inflection to the positive for the overall category. I think with all the restrictions we had last year, there's a lot of pent-up demand to be able to express yourself, to be able to get out there. In fact, June was the first month for the overall category that sales were above 2 years ago. And so we're definitely seeing consumers return to the category. And we're seeing, for us, strength across every one of our segments. We basically continue to build share. And we're the only top five brand, really, over a 2 year basis that's built a lot of share. And it's really because of the innovation that we have. We have products that really resonate with our consumers, and our ability to really engage them is the thing that continues to propel us.
What's your outlook as we come out of the pandemic? On the one hand, we are seeing folks leave their houses more and more often, folks willing to wear makeup to go to dinner, go to see their friends. But I'm also hearing from some of my friends actually say, listen, I haven't really worn makeup a lot throughout this pandemic, and I really like it. And now that I'm starting to leave my house again, I'm starting to rethink having to wear foundation and mascara and some other more traditional beauty items and makeup items. How are you perceiving this post-pandemic world that we're going to be in, particularly when it comes to purchasing makeup and other beauty items?
Well, I'm actually quite bullish on the category. As I mentioned, the category is coming back. We see a lot of consumer interest. And for e.l.f. in particular, I think we're well positioned. We have a very strong base in our core complexion products, our primers or concealers, products that you don't actually have a full face of makeup to still make great benefits, as well as our growing skincare range. We have continued to have real strength across our skincare items, and that includes expansion of our brand portfolio. With the acquisition of Well People, a pioneering clean beauty brand that really appeals to consumers who are looking for much more conscious about the ingredients in their products, or our groundbreaking lifestyle beauty brand, Key Soul Care, that we developed with Alicia Keys. That's really about self-care, self-love, and rituals. That's really changing the scope of conversation in our space. So we're able to appeal to a broad set of consumers really through a robust portfolio that has momentum across every one of our brands.
Tarang, we talked to a lot of CEOs here who have been complaining about supply chain bottlenecks, and I'm wondering if you're experiencing the same thing there at e.l.f., and if inflation is starting to seep in, are you able to absorb those costs, or do you envision having to pass those along to the consumer in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, certainly we've been impacted like everyone else by the global imbalance of containers. I'm actually proud of our team of how we've been able to navigate that. In the quarter, our in-stock levels are 95%. That really talks to strength that we have with our retail partners and online. Certainly costs are elevated due to that, but you know, I consider that temporal in nature. I feel like over time, global imbalances tend to balance out, and I feel like we're really well positioned with the best combination of cost, quality, and speed in our space.
Tarang, I want to ask you about some of the ventures that e.l.f. has been going into, getting into gaming through a channel on Twitch. I see that there's also attempts to attract some Gen Z customers on TikTok. Tell us a little bit about that strategy.
Yeah, so our strategy is really to engage our consumers and find where they're most comfortable. So our foray onto TikTok, we're one of the first beauty brands on TikTok. Our latest challenge, TikTok Gamers Got Talent, generated over 17 billion views. So it's been remarkable the level of engagement we've been able to see on that platform. But similarly in gaming, it came from a simple insight that 70% of our consumers play video games. 65% of them watch others play video games on platforms like Twitch and YouTube. And so it was a natural thing for us to do and really engage, and particularly our partnership with Lufu, the world's second largest gamer, female gamer, on empowerment, things that tie into our core values as a brand, we found is a great way of continuing to engage with our community.
Well, you have definitely found the secret sauce there, I think. Tarang Amin, CEO of e.l.f. Beauty, congratulations again on those results, and thanks for being with us.
Taking a look here at shares of Angie, stock off about 1.5%, company out last night with a quarter that was ever so slightly shy of revenue estimates and a slightly wider than expected loss, essentially in line with estimates, though, across the board. Joining us now to talk about the state of Angie's business, Oisin Hanrahan, the company's CEO. Oisin, thanks for jumping on this morning. I want to start with something that came up at the beginning of the call last night, and Joey talked about it at length, which is sort of the new brand portfolio, the way you guys have put some brands together under the Angie umbrella. And I'm just curious if you could, you know, kind of spell out what's in there now and sort of how that strategy is playing out for you guys.
For sure. Thanks for having me. Great to be here today. So we're really excited about the opportunity we've got to build a really durable, longstanding consumer brand that people turn to for everything in their home. You think about the great brands that have been built. And there's a big opportunity for us to build a brand around Angie. The Angie's List brand has been around for a really long time. It's been around for 20 years, loved by consumers, a lot of resonance with that brand. The issue is it's a little bit too literal in that it was originally a list. And Angie is no longer a list. Consumer expectations have changed. You think about all the ways that consumers want to engage with things now. They want to tap a button on their phone and get something done. And that's why we've dropped List from the brand. And we've really leaned into the Angie brand in the last few months. We've rebranded Angie's List to Angie. We've put Angie as our primary consumer brand, our flagship brand. And we're really getting behind that brand. We've invested in it in terms of moving our mobile app over, invested TV behind it. And we're now at a point where we're seeing really strong growth in the aided and unaided awareness for that brand. So it's really about building this one location that every consumer trusts to take care of everything inside their home.
part of the secret sauce, I imagine, is the ability just to go online and search for your brand. So you made that domain shift, and that has pressured results. Has the search traffic to your site, has that bottomed? Are you starting to see that turn the corner?
Look, we've got a number of different things going on. So we've got the Angie's List to Angie domain transition, and that's doing really well. So IAC has done this many times before with some of their dot dash brands, and that is performing, frankly, better than expected. So the Angie's List to Angie domain transition doing really well. The traffic is rebounding. It's accelerating off the decline that we would have seen from the domain transition. Where we're seeing a little bit of challenge is on the HomeAdvisor brand, where as we've shifted our advertising dollars over from HomeAdvisor to Angie, what we're actually seeing is that brand is degrading at a faster rate than we would have thought. And that, frankly, has given us more confidence than ever to invest behind the Angie brand. So we're getting somewhere between 7 and 10 times more awareness per dollar spent on Angie than we ever were on HomeAdvisor, which again, perhaps speaks to the literal nature of the name. It's perhaps a little too generic. Whereas Angie as a brand, it really stands out. It's a great brand that we're excited to invest in.
So, Oisin, let's talk a little bit about what's on there right now. And I want to ask about supply because and really competition, let's say, in the pro market, competition to get jobs done. Anybody who owns a home now has tried to do anything to their home knows how hard it is to get someone on the phone, let alone get them to come and do something. What has that been like for you guys in the last year? Because you noted basically during COVID, everything stopped. And now it's at this speed that sort of has felt unsustainable. I don't know how you guys are seeing maybe the other side of this.
Look, I think you've got some pretty unprecedented things going on where you saw consumer demand accelerate at probably the fastest rate it's ever accelerated for anything in the home. And then you had supply contract at probably the fastest rate it's ever contracted, and then gradually start to rebound. And then you add on top of that the complications of actual supply chains of shingles, concrete, steel, et cetera. And it's been a challenging environment. So we got two businesses within Angie, two primary business models. One where pros pay us to access customers, and that business has been challenged. So, you know, where pros are as busy as they have been, it's obvious that there's challenges getting them to invest more and growing their customer base. The second business we've got is the Angie Services model, where customers pay us to do work. And that business has been incredible. So that business is up 127% year on year in Q2 to $73 million. You think about that growth rate at a business of that scale, it's frankly incredible. And then you look at July, where it's up 166% year on year in July. So our Angie Services business is the one where we're really seeing phenomenal growth. Obviously, we think that the supply demand imbalance that you've got going on is probably temporary. And we expect to see some normalization there, and we expect to see significant recovery in the ratio between supply and demand as we get through this pandemic. But we've really been very fortunate in our ability to bring on more and more supply into that Angie Services model. And I think that speaks to great product market fit. It speaks to the fact that consumers are trusting Angie. They're saying, yes, I will pay Angie to do work inside my home. And pros are saying, yeah, I'd love to sell work directly through Angie. Let me sign up to do that. So the fact that, even during all this shortage, the fact that we can grow that business 127% year on year, Q2 v Q2 last year, is a great result.
We've seen, I would say, over the past year or so, a Home Depot, a Lowe's getting more involved with services. I think Home Depot is now loaning out tools. Has that had any impact on your business?
So one of the parts of the Angie Services model is actually we partner with major retailers. So when you go to certain retailers and you want to get you want to get a TV mount, or you want to get a TV, for example, at Walmart, you can actually buy the TV mounting service provided by Angie in a Walmart store. So we actually, one of our models for Angie Services is to meet the customer wherever they are. If the customer wants to pick service first, which we hope they will, and they come to Angie, then we're going to sell them the service right there on the site or in the mobile app. If they want to pick the product first, then we're going to partner with major retailers to sell the service alongside the product. So it really is a multi-channel distribution strategy that brings the best experience possible to customers. Ultimately, we have two goals, right? We want to make sure that whatever the homeowner wants to get done inside their home, they turn to Angie to get the job done. And if whatever you know way a pro wants to grow their business, that they turn to Angie to help them grow that business. And we do those two things, we'll be on the right path.
All right, we'll leave it there. Angie, CEO, Sheen Hanrahan, appreciate the time this morning. Best of luck, and I know we'll be in touch.
Thanks.